Thank you very much, Professor Gupta. So maybe I can ask the three speakers to come on the podium to answer some questions, because as a nephrologist, I'm a little bit depressed, because this morning we learned EKI is a CKD transition phase initiation of the modality does not affect the outcome of the patient. Cardiologists are depressing, no drug is working, bypassing, and all these are the same outcome. So I don't know what to do. We have to survive and to keep running the patient on dialysis. So we have to find a solution. It's open for the discussion and a question. We'd be happy to have to take your questions. State your name and affiliation. Yeah. On the right, please.
Tokir Karim, I have a question for Dr. Kian. It's about the, you mentioned in your talk that AKI is increasing in the incidence rate and the severity, you know, the mortality is proportional to the severity. And then you mentioned about the non-traditional sensitive biomarkers. So where are we in terms of, you know, there has been a lot of contemporary research taken in the field in terms of NGAL, KIM-1, LFAB, you know, interleukin-18, and there have been studies shown in population with sepsis who undergo CABG and then contrast-induced nephropathy. So where are we in terms of generalizability, you know, because it's not yet been, and that's probably the reason why we are lagging behind. You know, in terms of, again, my cardiologist colleague will agree with me that acute myocardial infarction, we have had these new biomarkers like troponin and other things since they came in, mortality rates has significantly come down. You know, the outcomes are much better.
Yeah. No, this is a loaded question, but that's a very good question. If I could give you an answer, then we will have a breakthrough. But the issue with the nephrology is that unlike a troponin, the positive predictive value and negative predictive values are far, far inferior compared to troponin. So even if you have a positive, for instance, NGAL, just take an example. NGAL is produced by multiple tissues, including hepatic tissue. Let's say if the patient's coming in with sepsis, and you could have a hepatic generation of NGAL, which is freely filtered at the glomerulus. So when you detect the NGAL in the urine, would you interpret as a proximal release NGAL or systemic release NGAL filtered through? So there's a multiple issues, details, you know, it's devil's in the details, has not been worked out. Another issue is when patient coming into the clinic or into the hospital setting, sometimes there's a stuttering onset of worsening kidney function, increased creatinine. We saw that all the time, gradually coming up. When you look at specific markers, it could be negative because you've already passed the window period where you have this dynamic release of the signals. And another issue is the cutoff. So where are we set at the cutoff? For instance, post-CABG AKI versus sepsis AKI. If we have precisely know the onset of injury, then we know this is an early marker in terms of 6-8 hours. But what's the cutoff? The study has shown different trigger of AKI, you have to use a different cutoff level to determine whether there's a tubular injury or non-tubular injury. So having said that, we know more mechanics and the research is still ongoing. Maybe next year we have a much better answer to it. Yeah. But at the moment, it's not mature enough to be used.
Yeah. Just on this note, you know, in drug, I've been doing drug development, and part of my, you know, part was safety evaluation. So during the drug development process, you know, like a molecule or a biological agent, where we know that this drug has a good ability to sort of meet the unmet need, you know, so we have used these biomarkers to establish the no observed effect level at a much earlier phase rather than keeping these patients safe, you know, the study volunteers. that's why it was a very useful tool.
Yeah, I think it could be a parallel process in the animal study, preclinical study, and clinical study, but that's what the current state is.
Thank you. So, thank you. Ladies first, yeah, Dr. Madera.
Magdalena Madero, Mexico City. This is a question for Dr. Gupta. So our CKD patients most of the times do not have symptoms from coronary artery disease. And the question is, do you think we should be screening for acute coronary syndrome or coronary artery disease, even if asymptomatic? And which test do you think we should be implementing? And then the final question is what to do about it if you were to find something positive. The patients do not have symptoms.
I don't have a good answer for you. The fact is that how often do you screen? Do you screen once a week, once a month? Do you screen every patient who comes in the hospital? If their troponin is positive or their BNP is positive, does that indicate that the heart's under strain and has nothing to do with coronary disease? If the troponin is positive and their creatinine is 3.5, do we say, look, we're going to accept the risk of contrast-induced nephropathy, although it's probably relatively trivial, find out that they have multivessel coronary disease, and then what? Because I just showed you that the mortality is abysmal at that point. I think that what I've shown in these slides is that revascularization for acute symptoms, so NSTEMI and STEMI in patients with symptoms, is beneficial. Our prophylactic treatment of coronary disease, even in the non-kidney disease patient, is terrible. And so I would argue not to screen these patients even if they're asymptomatic. Now, symptoms may be different. So if they're presenting with worsening breathlessness or difficulty managing their volume and perhaps have new evidence of LV dysfunction, that may be a reasonable reason to go ahead and pursue coronary angiography in and of itself. But completely without symptoms, I wouldn't know where to start, and we have no evidence to show that that's ever been beneficial.
Unless there's this subgroup of patients that will get a kidney transplant, then, you know, those patients should be screened, right?
Yeah. So there are guidelines for this, too. I didn't have enough time to put those slides up. I can tell you anecdotally that stenting patients who have no symptoms to get them ready for a kidney transplant is one of the scarier things that I've done. And the reason is because I'm putting intracoronary stents in patients who have coronary disease, and I'm replacing one disease with another. I'm replacing the coronary disease with the disease of a stent. And it's unclear to me that replacing coronary disease with the disease of a stent reduces their risk of kidney transplant. I know there's guidelines for it. We follow the guidelines. But it makes me very nervous.
Thank you.
And I love putting stents in, so for me to be nervous about that is not good.
Thank you. So on the right, is the second mic? Mike, yeah.
My name is Mike Plager. I work in New England. My question is for Dr. DeGurtis regarding clearance data in patients with residual renal function. You know, up until a few years ago, we would do residual, you know, testing and do modeling to see what their KTOV combined was, and that's basically been phased out. So now we're being graded on clearance data that is solely based on their dialysis. So if we try to shorten their treatments because they have significant function, then their KTOV may be below par and we're dinged for it. In today's pay for performance, you know, that can be a pretty significant effect on us. Any comments about how that can be rectified or how to better handle that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. And I think the big tragedy is in the past, people were only measuring renal function because they saw a benefit of adjusting the dose. And now that we're not measuring kidney function, we're missing a lot of data in terms of what could preserve it. I mean, if we had residual kidney function on all the patients in the country, we'd have an enormously powerful database in terms of what preserves kidney function. I think part of the reason is also complexity. And I suspect that simply measuring urinary volume or even a questionnaire given to patients annually on how much urine they make would give a lot of the same information as residual kidney function. Now, in terms of guidelines from CMS, I mean, all we can do is, when we were part of KDOQI, we wanted to be very non-restrictive. And so in 2006, we said the KDOQI guidelines only apply when residual kidney function is less than 2. And above that, we were silent in terms of dose. And then we had some ideas of how to adjust for it because there was no evidence. So it's not our fault that when CMS takes guidelines, makes recommendations and quality improvement targets and pay for performance targets that were not based on guidelines. They're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to take only data from the guidelines and then work from that to develop quality improvement standards. We're sort of faced with the same idea now with ultrafiltration targets, where really we don't know whether the ultrafiltration target should be mils per kilogram or should be a straight milliliter, but there's just a lot of pressure to improve, to do quality. People want to do the right thing, and so government tends to do this sort of thing. And I think we're stuck. I mean, we tried to anticipate this problem in the guidelines in 2006 and write in exceptions for that, but CMS doesn't do it. So I think it's more a discussion that we need to, that our regulatory bodies need to take with CMS to give people more flexibility.
All right. Quick question. No, quick
thanks.
Answer.
My answer, yeah. It has been answered already. Thank you.
Okay, so on.
Hi, John Vidine. When I return home to San Diego, one of my big hospitals is going to have adopted the biomarkers for measuring AKI in urine. It's the insulin growth factor binding protein and the TIMP protein. And so this was driven by cardiovascular surgeons, and so I anticipate being awoken in the middle of the night with an abnormal test, and just would like some advice. Should I just roll over in bed, or should I put on my shoes and go in?
Yeah, so the most promising marker is what you said, IGF-BP7 and TIMP2, and that the combination is worked out very nice with high precision proportional to the degree of kidney injury. But as you said, it's applied to a very well-defined population. In your population would be the post-surgery patient. You know exactly when is the injury, and you have a time frame in terms of when to monitor, and these as an early signal of tubular injury. And these are not run-of-the-mill AKI that we see, hodgepodge of all kinds of pneumonia, sepsis. So it would be a very nice experience from your institution and see what's the outcome. Is it adaptable, to different institutions, but I think a post-operative AKI is one of the AKI that's most predictable because we know time zero. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do with elevation? The issue with AKI is once it occurs, you can only provide supportive care to make sure all the ABCDE volume, blood pressure, perfusion, decrease congestion and all kinds of maneuvers to increase the tissue oxygen delivery. For the patient with post-op, one of the major issues that I've experienced is that too aggressive fluids with the vascular health staff, the surgery health staff tend to give loads of fluids and cause intracapsular, subcapsular pressure buildup, and it's effectively squeeze out all the oxygen deliveries. It's essentially prolong AKI and retard the progression. And these are something that you can do. There's really not much specific treatment once the AKI is set in. You have any comments?
No, I think it's a very good point. Especially about the use. I keep wondering when these, I've been hearing about all these markers now for 4, 5, 6 years, and, when are they finally going to come into the clinical arena? And I didn't know if what the problems were driving it. Obviously, this is one problem, knowing what to do with them, but But I do believe that the post-operative frame, especially the post-cardiac surgery frame, I mean, hell, you get a pre-op marker on, as part of the pre-op workup as well to improve the predictive value. If you know you're going to operate on somebody and you want to, you know you're going to follow this.
But just being, having you in the picture, the patient's mortality rate will decrease. And that's just our experience. You may lose sleep, but the patient could have less progression and could have a mortality benefits.
Okay, so because of time, we have to close the session and just want to thank all the speakers for the fantastic and talk, and thank also for the audience for the interactive questioning. Thank you very much.